MacCast, Friday, July 18th, 2014. Hey, Mac Geeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for Mac Geeks by Mac Geeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, we got a really big show for you today. It's been a little while since we talked, so the stories have piled up a little bit, but that's a good thing. It means that we have new, interesting, and exciting things to talk about, as well as some of the old stuff, right? We always have to get back to the rumors, especially iPhone 6 rumors. But we're also going to be talking about when we might see updated MacBooks and MacBook Pros and MacBook Airs, especially with new Intel processors, all the latest on those iPhone rumors and things like that. Also, Apple asked to do a little bit more on the accessibility front, which is interesting. We'll talk about that a little bit. Some updates to the Apple TV. Also, all your iWatch stuff, and Apple is pushing in further into the enterprise with a new partner. We've got all that in the news, plus some hints and tips and tricks for you. We're going to talk about restoring your recovery partition and also a little bit more on SSDs. Going to explain a little bit on how to use the Find My feature, so Find My Mac specifically, and then someone asked a question about using iTunes Match. We're going to address that along with a great Wi-Fi tip that was given out over at the Mac Observer. So we got all that, and we're going to be getting into that in just a minute. But before we get started, I do want to take a quick moment and thank one of my show sponsors, and that is Sanebox. If you're like me, you get a ton of email. We all get a ton of email, right? Because you sign up for lists, and some of it's stuff that you want, some of it's stuff that you maybe don't want, but all of it ends up in your inbox. And your inbox clutter, I guess, is what we're talking about. And Sanebox is a tool that can really help with that. It helps in prioritizing. And of course, you could go in and you could set up all kinds of complex rules based on senders and stuff like that. You don't have to do that with Sanebox. And that's what I really love about it. It moves the unimportant emails out of your inbox, giving you a cleaner, simpler inbox, and then still you have all that mail that you can go through and parse later. It's really about prioritizing, and that's just the core of the application. It can do a bunch more stuff, and one thing that's really great is it works everywhere. It works with any email provider, any client, any device, so iOS, Android, Mac, PC, doesn't really matter. It's going to work with all of your email accounts to help prioritize and clean up that inbox. How does it know what to do? How does it know what's important? That's where it gets really neat, because you don't have to set up any complex rules in advance. It looks at how you read your email, what you do, which emails you open, what you respond to, how quickly you respond to that, and then prioritizes all of it automatically, putting it into different boxes. They have things like the same later box or the same bulk box for all of your order receipts and transactional kinds of emails. And it does all of that without ever looking at any of the content. It's only looking at the headers. So if you're worried about security and all those sorts of things, they got you covered there. And they're always adding new kinds of features. One of my favorite ones that I've been using recently is called Say Not Spam. That's the kind of thing. How often have you had something end up in your spam folder and it's not supposed to be there? It happens, right? Well, it'll start to recognize those things and you'll be able to more easily catch emails that aren't supposed to be in spam. And training is literally just moving it from one box to the other. It will watch and recognize, oh, that is now something that should be over in Sane News or Sane Later. It's really, really cool. And like I said, there's a ton of other features. They have one click on subscriber. They have the ability to snooze emails that aren't urgent. So if something comes in your inbox, but you want to address it maybe a couple days later or a week later, you can set up mechanisms for that. You can have it automatically take all of your attachments and put them into Dropbox and other services. So it is a really great service, and I want you to give it a try. You can try it for free. You can get a free trial plus a $10 credit on your Sanebox order just by going to sanebox.com/MacCast. I use the service every day. I've come to rely on it. I can't imagine not having it. So try it out, and a big thank you to Sanebox for their support of the MacCast. If you've been waiting on a new MacBook Pro, a MacBook Air, and you're hoping to get the latest Intel technology in there, you might have to wait a little while longer. It looks like Intel is delaying their processors once again. A Chinese site reports that Intel has delayed the release of its next generation Broadwell chips, those are the processors that would likely be the processor in updated MacBook Pros and MacBook Airs, or very likely the ones that Apple wants to use. In May, Intel CEO promised that the Broadwell would be here for the 2014 holiday season, and according to Mac rumors, he will keep his promise, but just barely, but it's not going to help with updated MacBook Pros and MacBook Airs. The new Broadwells will only be out in the Core M line, which is the ultra-low power version used in products like 2-in-1 computers. So those like the tablet computers, or I guess the, and we don't really call them netbooks anymore, but the lower powered stuff. And it looks like the chips that Apple would want are not really going to be here until early 2015 at the soonest. And that was a rumor that was echoed by CNET. The Broadwell was originally slated to enter production in late 2013 before the production was then delayed till the first quarter of 2014, and then it was delayed once again to the third quarter of 2014, and now it's looking like it's not going to be until next year. The issue seems to be trouble nailing down a new manufacturing process. They're moving to 14 nanometer to fabricate the chips, and that seems to be giving them some production issues. Now, we've heard that Apple's been planning a fall update for the Retina MacBook Pro line, and there's also been those rumors about a 12-inch MacBook Air surfacing at some point. But if they do those updates this fall, it looks like they're going to have to rely on the latest Haswell technology, the current generation of chips, probably bumping up some of the specs like the processor speed and those sorts of things. But not the new line of Broadwells showing up, in at least not this year. Now, the current generation of Retina MacBook Pros already run Haswell, and if you remember, the MacBook Airs just got updated to Haswell with a refresh back in April, along with a price drop. So that really, in Apple's lineup, leaves only the Mac Mini as the last product to get a Haswell upgrade, and it's not clear if or when Apple's going to do that. Hopefully, they would be updating the Mac Minis here in the fall also. One of my favorite lines is the Mac Mini line, and it'd be nice to see that get a little bit of love. But once the Broadwell is available, we can expect 30% faster performance along with more energy efficiency over the Haswell. And it looks like the first dual-core Broadwell chips with GT3, HD5000, or Iris graphics, the ones that would be destined for something like a MacBook Air, those aren't going to arrive until February of 2015 at the earliest. The quad-core versions of the chips with the Iris Pro graphics, the ones more suited for the MacBook Pro line, are now expected to be ready in about a year, July of 2015 or so. What's weird about the timing of that is the delayed release could put Apple really in a bind for the after-Broadwell generation of chips, codenamed Skylake. Those are due to arrive in late 2015, so if the Broadwells aren't due out until July, mid-2015, and then they're going to immediately follow with the Skywells, it could be the kind of thing where Apple waits to update the line to, you know, just skips a whole generation of Intel and does that again in the fall. So we might have Haswell this fall, a Haswell update, a little speed bump, things like that, and then a full year until we see new models with the Skylake processors. That's assuming those stay on target for their time, and if history repeats itself, those could get pushed back also. So, like IBM for Apple in the 90s, Intel might be losing a little bit of its edge and its appeal, because we also have been hearing rumors that Apple has been looking at moving some of its machines possibly to its own chip designs. Apple's been very successful with the A-series chips in the iPhone and in iPads, and there's been these long-standing rumors that Apple may do a MacBook Air with that and may eventually move to using their own processor designs for all of their computers. I'm not certain that's going to happen anytime soon, but Apple would definitely be focusing less on upping the performance, the GPU cycles, things like that, and looking at increased battery life and reducing heat, especially for portable lines. And when it does come to desktops and notebook CPUs, right now it still seems like Intel's the choice, but only time will tell if Apple can actually make the move and if they think that's sort of the future of their systems. I'd be curious to know what you think. I think Apple's not ready to move into doing processors for their notebooks and desktops quite yet, but who knows, in a couple years, 2-3 years from now, maybe we will see Apple doing that. They certainly have the talent in-house to design those chips. They can find manufacturing partners like Samsung to actually do chip fabrication. And who knows, even further down the line, we could see Apple moving into chip fabrication themselves. They really like to sort of own everything front to end, and maybe that's the direction they're going to have to move to kind of eke out the performance and the specifications from their processors like they do with their other components. As we get closer and closer to the announcement of the iPhone 6, which is expected to happen sometime this fall, Apple is shoring up its production, and the rumors surrounding the iPhone 6 seem to be getting a little bit more solid. There's a lot less ambiguity to the rumors we've been hearing. Apple, no doubt, has started up ramping production, and we're seeing more and more parts leaking out for the iPhone 6 that I think are looking more and more legitimate. Most recently, we've seen some back shells surface, and we've been seeing now that they illustrate some of the rumored design changes that we'd been hearing about for a while. Some of the latest images show a cutout logo like on the iPad. This could be there for a little bit more radio transparency. Some people are theorizing that the logo could contain and hide the NFC antenna. I'm still in the camp of people who think that there's not going to be near-field communications technology inside the iPhone, but it still could help with some of the cellular data reception as well, and also could add a nice touch of a glowing logo accent like Apple has in their notebooks. Whether or not that'll happen, I'm kind of indifferent on. It's been rumored, but again, it could just end up looking more like the back of your iPad. Some of the back shells we've been seeing also show the antenna brakes a little bit more clearly. It was discovered or has been sort of being talked about that, like a lot of the sort of mock-ups we've been seeing, Apple is not going to have a metal panel in that end area, that sort of end cap area where those antenna brakes happen. That was a design feature that I felt looked a little bit ugly. Those are just sort of in the mock-ups, in-place elements, and they're expected to be replaced by more glass-like elements like on the current iPhone 5S. And also, we're able to see now with some of these latest part leaks that those antenna brakes appear to be made of a non-conductive polymer, and some of the reports I've been reading say that is to help better insulate the different antennas from each other. So there's multiple antennas for different purposes within the iPhone, and that should help out, again, with reception and transmission of those signals. The holes on the left side also show one of the design elements we've been hearing about, that there's going to be pill-shaped volume rocker buttons rather than the round ones in the current design. Also on the left side is your sleep-wake buttonhole in those images. And then the right edge shows the SIM tray cutout, but more interestingly, it also shows a second cutout with which many people are speculating to be the button for power sleep-wake functions, which has reportedly been moved from the top of the iPhone over to the side. I'm a little bit curious about this one because it seems like that would be an area where it would get accidentally bumped or triggered more frequently. I don't know why I feel that way. I guess maybe because I keep my phone in my front pocket, and I would think sliding it in and out, I may actually, as I'm grabbing it out, touch that button or bump into it more so than I would when it was on the end. And it makes me a bit curious about why exactly Apple would want to move that button or need to move that button from the top of the phone. I guess it maybe gives a little more clean look to the top edge of the iPhone, but it does seem a little bit of a curious change to me. Something else about the back panel images, we've seen a couple different colors, and more recently we've seen this kind of darker color, almost a black, a darker than space gray case, and we had not heard any rumors that Apple was changing up the colors prior to these leaks. So it does maybe call into question the leaks a little bit, or maybe it's just the fact that Apple wants to move more back toward a dark or a black style phone with the release of the iPhone 6. We're also starting to get some details about the next generation processor. Apple Insider has been reporting that Taiwan Semiconductor Manufacturing, TSMC, has begun production of Apple's A-series processor chips for the iPhone 6, and they're now making their way to assembly plants to start production of the next generation iPhone. The new chip is being produced on a 20 nanometer fabrication line, and those lines reportedly started up in the first quarter, but now appear to be ramping up to full production mode. Samsung still remains the main producer of Apple's A-series processor, but TSMC is expected to get more and more of Apple's business moving forward. The A8 chips in the next generation phone are expected to remain at 64-bit dual core, but Apple is expected to bump the processor speed up to 2.0 gigahertz. Many of Apple's competitors, for comparison, are still using 32-bit processors, but using quad-core designs. And while that may seem like an advantage, recent tests done by AnandTech on the current A7 processors, which are dual-core 64-bit, have shown that they outperform many of the other players in the mobile phone marketplace. They also noted that no apps currently, or almost no apps currently, are able to fully maximize even the power of the A7 processor running at its current megahertz and clock speeds. So I think we may be facing a kind of new round of megahertz myth when it comes to mobile processors, and Apple staying at dual core and just bumping up the CPU cycles should give a big advantage, especially considering that Apple kind of controls the end-to-end experience, so they can really tailor the hardware and software to work together to eke the maximum performance even out of a dual core chip on a mobile device. And plus, they have that advantage of running at 64 bits versus 32, another thing that some of Apple's competitors would want you to think doesn't matter, but real-world testing seems to be proving differently. Apple also might be looking to TSMC to take on the bulk of A-series production after the A8. The next version of Apple's mobile processor is expected to be a quad-core design, and Apple and TSMC are also rumored to be collaborating on the research and development for moving to a smaller 16-nanometer production process sometime next year. But that relationship might be a little bit in flux, a little bit shaky, because if TSMC can't deliver on the new process and the new chips, Apple may look back to one of its old frenemies for support. A separate report from the Commercial Times says that Qualcomm is currently working with Samsung on a 14-nanometer process of their own, and they speculate that if TSMC can't get the job done for Apple, Apple might look to switch back to Samsung for A-series production on the iPhone 6S, which could happen as production starts up around the second half of 2015. Frankly, when I read this report, I really didn't find the information surprising. Apple has always been nimble and flexible with its suppliers, and they like to have a couple of different options in their pocket moving forward. They like to keep those options open. So I'm going to guess that they're going to continue to work with TSMC and Samsung, and as they get closer and closer to production time, they will make those decisions about who can best support their business. And oftentimes, they're probably going to have multiple suppliers. So I'm guessing moving forward, they will just sort of fluctuate the percentage of who has more of the business, Samsung, TSMC, and they could even bring on additional manufacturers as they move forward. So who knows? Also, a big component in the iPhone, next generation iPhone, that we've been talking a lot about is that new screen. It's fully expected that Apple is going to be using Sapphire for that. And more recently, we've seen reportedly some screens that are supposed to be the actual Sapphire displays that will show up in a 4.7-inch iPhone 6. Now, the leaks showed some pretty impressive torture tests with a guy hacking, slashing, pounding, bending the displays, taking a knife to it, trying to scratch it, and was unable to scratch the device. It was also noted in the report that the screens were super clear. Sapphire is known for its clarity. It did shatter in some other tests, I think out of China, under the weight of a 1.6-ton vehicle, so it's not indestructible. But Apple's competitors are about to be at a huge disadvantage if what we've been seeing in these leaks turns out to be true. A lot of Apple's competitors are saying that the cost and the easier breakability really makes Sapphire, especially in drop tests, the breakability and drop tests, make Sapphire not as desirable of a material. But I think what has happened is Apple's developed a new manufacturing process and a new material that addresses some of those downsides. I think they've solved some of the component cost pieces, and I also think that they've developed a material that has some superior qualities to just standard sapphire glass, and also is vastly superior to the Gorilla Glass technology that Apple's competitors are using, and they're going to have a hard time matching it if they aren't able to, again, move to another material like sapphire. But I think Apple probably has some patents. Actually, as a matter of fact, we've seen some patents cited where Apple has developed new processes for layering sapphire material with other materials to give it more flexibility, more durability than just the standard material. And as a matter of fact, in a follow-up recently to the torture tests a lot of people called into question actually testing, scratch testing with metal, because metals actually are a lot softer than glasses. So typically most metals won't scratch Gorilla Glass. They will not scratch Sapphire Glass. So the same tester took some sandpaper using different materials like granite and things with a higher hardness to even the sapphire, and was actually able to put some scratches, some pretty good scratches, into that sapphire glass display that they had. So what that shows is that really Apple's display is probably not 100% pure sapphire. I will note that they also took the sandpaper to the iPhone 5S, which uses Gorilla Glass, and that scratched to extreme measures, where the sapphire material held up a lot better. And so it really does show that Apple has developed some sort of new process. I think that's why we saw the flexibility in the display that we saw in that testing. And it sort of proves that Apple is using a hybrid material that offers better scratch resistance than Gorilla Glass, but maybe isn't quite as hard as 100% pure sapphire, but is going to have some properties that are going to give it a big advantage over the current Gorilla Glass. And it's going to address some of the flexibility and impact issues that Apple's competitors have had. And I'm guessing also they've addressed some of the costing issues, especially in volume and by working closely with their partner GT Advanced. And that is going to be a combination that Apple's competitors are going to be scrambling to match. There also seems to be some conflicting reports on just how many displays Apple is going to be able to manufacture through their partner. Some analysts, specifically analysts from NPD Display Search, claim that Apple and GT Advanced, their capacity right now is at about 45 million units for the iPhone 6 launch. Now, predictions are that Apple wants to ship about 70 million iPhone 6 units at launch, so they would fall a little bit short of being able to supply Sapphire Glass panels for all of those phones if NPD Display Search is right. But a conflicting report from JP Morgan says that Sapphire production for phone displays is just at 10 million units, which means Apple would come up extremely short. If that turns out to be the case, they're saying that their sources say Sapphire might be only available in the extreme high end of the iPhone 6 models. Something like the rumored 128 gigabyte version might be the only version of the iPhone 6 seeing those Sapphire displays. I'm not putting a lot of stock in that. I think prior to this latest round of rumors, we've been hearing that iPhone Sapphire Glass display production was ramping up very, very nicely. As a matter of fact, some had pegged production currently at about 100 million units with GT Advanced, and saying they could be ramping up to be at 200 million units sometime in the near future. So I'm erring on the NPD Display Search side of things. Apple may have had some production issues. They might be falling short of maybe that 100 million unit mark, but I think they're going to be right in there in the 50, 60, 70 million units. And I think there might be a little bit of a delay and shortage in terms of iPhone 6 units at launch. They're always hard to get. I think we might see that again. Matter of fact, it wouldn't surprise me if we saw that again. But I think that Apple's going to go with this new display technology, the Sapphire Glass display technology, across all of the models. I don't think it's going to be limited to just the high-end units. Another component that we've been hearing about and seeing some reported parts for is the new camera sensor. It was originally thought that we weren't going to see an upgrade in terms of megapixels, but a Chinese Sony enthusiast site is claiming that the iPhone 6 might contain a new 13 megapixel unit from Sony. This is kind of the first we're hearing about it, and it really does contradict some of those earlier rumors of Apple sticking with an improved 8 megapixel sensor. So I'm kind of giving this one, a 30% chance of being right. I think we might just see Apple sticking with an 8 megapixel and bumping up some of the other specs in terms of just giving you a better image with the same sort of resolution. But I think all the parts leaks we've been seeing to date pretty much are surrounding a 4.7-inch device, and that may be for a good reason. We'd been hearing these different reports that Apple's also working on a 5.5-inch model, but our favorite analyst, Ming-Chi Kuo, says that the 5.5-inch model may be at risk of not launching this year. As a matter of fact, he says the larger model is facing issues with its new in-cell touchscreen panel technology, as well as color unevenness and in the metal casing, and so Apple may decide not to released the iPhone 6 5.5 at the same time as the 4.7. These issues are also supposedly impacting a little bit the 4.7-inch model, but seem to be worse on the larger model, according to Cho. He claims that the 5.5-inch Sapphire panel is also not holding up as well in drop tests, and he thinks that all of this means that Apple would delay the release of the iPhone 5.5-inch at best, and actually it might not launch till late in 2014 after, he says, mid-November. I think that would be a little bit too late to hit the holiday season. And so I think Apple historically is not above just simply putting the kibosh on the 5.5-inch model and going with a 4.7-inch only for this year, and then saving the larger screen display, the 5.5-inch, to be next year's model. That contradicts a lot of the rumors we've been hearing. Almost everybody else is saying we're going to get a 4.7, then maybe followed by a 5.5 later. But I think that would only serve to alienate a lot of Apple's customers who ended up not waiting, buying a 4.7 and then seeing a 5.5 come out later in the year. Now, one theory is that Apple could announce both models at the same time. I think they'd have to do that, but historically that's not how Apple does things. So it'll be interesting to see what tactic they take when it comes to the panels. Another thing that had reportedly been delaying or causing issues for Apple with the iPhone 6 is the battery. That issue now does reportedly seem to be solved. Samsung and LG Chemical were supposedly having issues making batteries thin and flexible enough for the new iPhone 6. Once again, Economic Daily News reports that Apple found a new supplier in Taiwan that was actually up to the task. Simplo Technologies has reportedly been hired to produce the batteries that Apple needs for the iPhone 6 and can reportedly get them out on time. G4 Games also claims that a third supplier, Sunwoda, has been brought on board to supply additional iPhone 6 batteries as well. So there should be plenty of batteries to go around at launch. This is another example where we see Apple kind of has multiple suppliers, people lined up. And this was something that Tim Cook talked about when he was mentioning analysts and rumors and things like that, saying not to rely too much on what they're hearing in the supply chain, because there's a lot of moving pieces, a lot of things going on. But as far as the battery technology itself, it does seem to be a larger battery. We saw some images surface this week. It shows a 1,810 milliamp hour unit, which is only slightly larger than the 1,560 milliamp hour battery that's in the iPhone 5S. The size is also quite a bit smaller than the cells that are found in similarly sized phones from Apple's competitors. A lot of the Android phones have batteries up into the 2000 plus milliamp hour range. So some are thinking that Apple's battery life might not be as well, but I think, again, they're not thinking about the tight hardware and software integration and custom chip technology that Apple's able to integrate. So Apple can eke a lot more performance, a lot more battery savings and consumption out of their system than I think their competitors can. So even though it's only a slight bump in the battery size and we're getting a larger screen, which you would think would draw more power, I'm fully expecting the iPhone's battery life to be about on par with the iPhone 5S. I don't think they're going to drop down, but I don't think they're going to get much of a battery improvement. And that is one feature a lot of people would like to see. But I think Apple's trying to keep the size in terms of the thinness of the device down, and they're making some compromises there. So I wouldn't expect better battery performance, but I would expect the same as the current generation. And that's all of the latest we've been hearing on the different iPhone 6 components. I'm getting pretty excited about the iPhone 6 launch, and I would be totally happy if there was just one size, but I'd love to get your opinion on it. Would you be disappointed if Apple had to delay that 5.5-inch model? Send us some feedback. Shoot us an email, mattcast@gmail.com. There was a Reuters piece this week that caused a little bit of a stir in the Apple community, and it was because it highlighted a resolution that was approved by members at the National Federation for the Blind during a conference where they want the organization to press Apple harder to create and enforce accessibility standards. And if that resolution makes you say, huh, you're getting to the point of sort of what got the community in an uproar. the Apple community was irritated because arguably Apple does more than any of their competitors to actually make their products and services accessible. It's actually a big mantra for the company. So the resolution seemed a little bit odd, and the Reuters piece unfortunately reported things in a light that made it look like the organization was targeting or going after Apple. Now, jumping to that conclusion might be a little bit easy because in the past, Apple had some issues with the National Federation of the Blind over iTunes. And it also kind of points out that Apple doesn't always, you know, do the best job at accessibility. They try very hard, but if you go back to iTunes a few years ago, it was actually an application that was not very accessible. And there was a big call to get that because it was one of Apple's core products. It was central in being their media hub and working with their other products and services and devices that was targeted again by the National Federation of the Blind. Now, back in 2008, the organization did reach an agreement with Apple after sending the company a demand letter and also after having the Attorney General in Massachusetts open up an investigation. The problem was is that the Reuters piece said that the National Federation for the Blind actually sued Apple, which was not true, and the article was actually later corrected. But that was some of the kind of misreporting that led to a lot of confusion over this latest report. Now, the Reuters coverage was also a little more irritating because they selectively used a quote from Tim Cook and chopped it up in a way that made it seem like Apple was aware of the issues of accessibility and technology, but also left out the part that showed that Apple was actually working to change those things. So they kind of made it look like Apple knew about the problem, but wasn't really doing anything about it. In the Reuters piece, they said that Tim Cook described how people with disabilities live in a struggle to have their human dignity acknowledged, and that they're frequently left in the shadows of technology advancements that are the source of empowerment and attainment for others. And that's where they chopped off the quote. But the full quote actually goes like this. People with disabilities often find themselves in a struggle to have their human dignity acknowledged. They frequently are left in the shadows of technological advances that are a source of empowerment and attainment for others, comma, but Apple engineers push back against this unacceptable reality. They go to extraordinary lengths to make our products accessible to people with various disabilities, from blindness and deafness to various muscular disorders. So we all know that Apple has been a champion of accessibility. They've built it into their products. They've continued to enhance and improve it. We've talked about it a lot on the MacCast. And as a matter of fact, the National Federation for the Blind president also said in a recent statement that Apple has gone far beyond the scope of the original agreement. That's the settlement on iTunes in 2008. And, or it wasn't a settlement. I need to correct myself there. Beyond the agreement that they made back in 2008, and they've made a vast majority of their products accessible to the blind. So what's happening now with this current resolution is the Federation is actually seeking for Apple to do a little bit more, not just Apple, but also other companies like Google, to do more to enforce and require the accessibility guidelines in their apps. So while Apple makes the technology available to developers, there's no requirement when you build an app to actually build it as being accessible. Apple's built in the tools and the functionality and the ways that you can make it accessible very easily, but you don't have to implement that. So specifically, the resolution states that the organization calls upon Apple to work with the National Federation for the Blind to create and enforce policy standards and procedures to ensure the accessibility of all apps and to ensure that accessibility is not lost when an app is updated. So I think what's going on here is while Apple's operating system and many of Apple's apps have been made accessible, some of the third-party apps are falling short, and the association is getting a little bit frustrated with that. I think even more frustrating is that they pointed out that sometimes an app will be accessible, but then through a software update, either new features or even some of the existing features no longer become accessible. And because Apple has this review process, they kind of look at things like, well, Apple will block offensive content or apps that have offensive content and things like that, yet they don't necessarily mandate or have any standards for giving at least a base level of accessibility to those applications. So I can kind of see where where they're coming from, right? When you put it in that light, it doesn't seem like that odd of a request. And they're not really mandating anything or wanting to impose sanctions or filing any kind of lawsuit. They're just saying, hey, we want to put a little bit more pressure on Apple and their app and get Apple to try and pressure app developers a little bit more to make their applications accessible. And we're willing to work with the organization and to try and set those standards and sort of put things right. So, you know, I think one idea that I had after reading this was it might be nice for Apple to maybe just implement a accessible label that could be displayed on apps in the iTunes store that fully implement Apple's accessibility guidelines. And they could really use that as a highlight thing to say, these apps are going above and beyond, or these are the apps that are really doing it right and sort of set an example for other apps and other developers to kind of follow. And they could highlight and reward and let, you know, those app developers get a little more exposure. And also it would be an easy way to let customers who rely on accessibility know before they purchase or buy an app that the app is going to function and work for them like they need it to. So that was what was going on with this story. You know, a lot of the reports were really shedding a negative light. And so I kind of wanted to, again, do what we do on the MacCast, which is see things from all sides and kind of open it up. You know, I don't think that we want Apple policing app developers and forcing them to do accessibility, but I think some stronger encouragement certainly couldn't hurt. In case you missed it, there was a huge, huge update for the Apple TV this past week, and I'm being a little bit sarcastic, but personally, I think this is probably one of the biggest updates for the Apple TV that Apple has done to date. And the reason is you can finally get extras on movies on your Apple TV. Why it has taken Apple so long to bring this functionality to the Apple TV, I have no idea. But now when you play a purchased movie on your updated Apple TV 2 or Apple TV 3 for videos that have extra content, you will get a menu where you can access all of the extra bonus features and contents just like you would if you had purchased it via DVD or if you were watching it in iTunes on your Mac. Not only that, on the Mac side, they upgraded that extras content finally for HD movies to be HD extras content. You may or may not have known, in the past, if you had extras content, even on an HD movie that you bought in iTunes, the extras content wasn't in HD. So Apple is going through the process of upgrading and updating that content. I don't know if it's available for all movies that you've purchased on iTunes. My guess is not, but they're rolling more and more of that functionality out. So you need to be on firmware version 6.2, which was released last month to get the features. So I guess the update came out a while ago, but now the content is actually finally showing up and being supported. Of course, when you go into view the extra content, there's also some additional tabs, including a recommended tab that will offer up other movies that you might want to purchase based on the movie you're viewing. So Apple's always trying to, you know, get a little more revenue out of iTunes when they roll out these new features as well. But I'm very excited because I've stopped buying DVDs and the things that have that extra content. I've been relying on digital versions to do that. And now that I can watch that content right there on my Apple TV without having to do any kind of trickery or use AirPlay or anything like that, I'm pretty excited about. iTunes 11.3 is the update that also brought the HD extras content on the Mac. And it's no additional charge. That new upgraded content's just going to start showing up with the movies and things that you've already purchased. And they're also bringing the extras functionality to iOS 8 in the fall. So it'll be debuting on your iOS devices, your iPhones and iPads sometime in the near, well, in the fall. I was going to say sometime in the near future, but with the release of iOS 8 in the fall. Another thing on iTunes that's kind of happening that's a little bit sad is that many of the iTunes song previews, it's noted, are starting to revert back to the 30-second previews. For a while now, we've had 90-second previews on most audio tracks in iTunes. Mac Rumors noted that this was happening recently, and it really wasn't clear why at first, but a piece over on 9to5 Mac did point out a possible explanation. I guess when Apple actually made the switch to 90-second previews, they didn't have any kind of agreement with the labels to do that. They just sent them a letter advising them that they would be switching and saying that if you get this letter and you don't do anything about it, you basically agree to these new terms where we're going to be using 90-second previews. My guess is that now some of the labels objected to that, maybe had some back and forth with Apple and decided to actually not allow 90-second versions of their audio tracks. It's going to be interesting to see how consumers respond to this. I was a big fan of the longer samples. I think sometimes just in 30 seconds, it's hard to get a feel for the actual track. So I'm hoping that consumers will put some pressure back on the labels and maybe we'll get more 90-second previews back. But if you've noticed some of your previews being a little bit shorter in iTunes, that's what's going on. And then one other thing kind of related to the iTunes store is Apple seems to be testing out, or rolling out rather, a new passbook-based iTunes gift payment card system called iTunes Pass. This was actually first spotted over in Japan, but now appears to be rolling out to other stores, including the US, Australia, and the UK. I'm not sure all of the countries it's rolled out to, but basically what it allows you to do is put a little passbook or iTunes card, virtual iTunes card, in your passbook. It has a QR code on it, and what's interesting about it is how you charge up or add cash to the card. You don't do it through iTunes or through Passbook. What you actually do is you take your phone in to an Apple retail store. In the store, they can actually scan that QR code on the Passbook Pass, and then you pay them cash or credit card in store to recharge the account, and then you can use that money. It'll show up in your iTunes account to do iTunes Store and App Store purchases. So it's kind of like a digital Starbucks card kind of thing, but for the iTunes store, similar to if you had gone into a retail store and bought an iTunes card and then entered the code into the iTunes app or the iTunes store to charge up your account. Now you can just do it directly without actually having to buy a card. If you want to get an iTunes Pass of your own or see if it's available in your country or in your iTunes store, just go ahead and open up the iTunes store app on your iOS device. And then scroll down to the bottom, and you can click on the redeem button, and then scroll down, and you should see the iTunes Pass option. If you don't see it there, you can also open up iTunes Store, scroll down to the bottom, click on your account, your Apple ID, and then sign in if needed, and then tap on the View Account button to access your account. And if you scroll down, you should see an iTunes Pass section. You can tap on the link to add the card to your passbook. And then once you've done that, like I said, you go into an Apple store, ask a specialist to scan your card, and then you can add money to your balance. A lot of people are asking, well, why would you do this instead of just buying a gift card or using allowances or more of the digital ways? The few things that I can think of is one, it's quicker and easier way to add to your account with cash. Online, you're going to have to use a credit card. A lot of people don't have credit cards, so here you can go into an Apple store, pay cash, and get your cards charged up. You don't have to buy gift cards all the time, so it's a little bit more convenient, and it's really good for people who might not have credit cards. Believe it or not, not everybody in the world has credit cards. Maybe students, kids, those sorts of people. Now they can do this virtually in an Apple store and actually charge that up. And some people just prefer pay-as-you-go versus using a credit card or having a credit card on file with iTunes. So there's a few different reasons to have this. It looks like Apple's kind of testing it out, seeing where it goes. It'll be interesting to see how many people use this. I'm curious, are you going to use this? Is this something that you think you would take advantage of? I've added the Pass to my passbook. I don't know if I'll actually ever use it to charge up anything because my credit card's already tied to my iTunes account. I can buy anything whenever I want. But I really think this feature is not targeted at me. I think it's targeted at probably a different audience. Apple might be struggling to get its rumored iWatch out before the end of the year. We had been kind of hearing reports that Apple was planning to announce and tell us about the iWatch at their fall event, probably the same event where they're going to announce the iPhone 6. Well, now in a recent research note, KGI analyst Ming-Chi Kuo said the announcement of the iWatch has been pushed back till mid or late November with a release to follow before the end of 2014. So, you know, these rumors of Apple kind of delaying products into November, that really doesn't bode well for their holiday buying season. I think it's going to be hard to sell people on Apple devices if you're not announcing them until late mid-November and putting them out, you know, toward the end of December. But the reason he claims this is happening is that the device requires a whole new level of production, a whole new level of software integration for Apple. It's reportedly going to be the first Apple device with an AMOLED display. It's also a new level of sapphire glass production. It's a new system in a package chip to get the circuits down to size. It requires a major OS redesign to get it working and integrate it with that teeny tiny display. It's not really clear if it's going to be a variant of iOS or how Apple's actually going to do that. If you think about the user interface, it has to be scaled down and squished down for a device. You might argue, well, Apple has some experience doing this with the iPod Nano, but that still wasn't iOS. So if Apple really is using iOS for the iWatch, they've kind of figure out the UI. So packing all that stuff in and integrating it with the myriad of sensors we've been hearing about that it might have, getting through all the approvals and things like that, it's not surprising that Apple might have some production issues and it might be slowing things down. And, you know, the report from Quo seems to make a little bit of sense. But frankly, I wouldn't be surprised. I mean, if this is really what's going on, I wouldn't be surprised if Apple just doesn't launch the iWatch this year. I don't think there's any reason they actually have to get it out. I think they're getting very little pressure from competitors, even though the media and analysts and Wall Street seem to be putting a lot of pressure on Apple. That's something Apple typically doesn't kowtow to or bow down to. And I really think it's more important for Apple to get this device right. And I think Apple knows that. I think they will. They need to take the time to make sure that all the pieces are in place and that it just blows the market away when it comes out. It's got to blow away the competitors. It's got to go above and beyond anything that we've seen on the market so far. And frankly, in my opinion, that wouldn't be that hard. A lot of the devices that are out there now are not much more than notifications on your wrist. And that goes even for the Moto 360, which I think is impressive for its design acumen, for its, you know, its shape, the fashion sense of it. I think Apple needs to mimic that level of fashion and design, and I think they will, but I think it needs to go above and beyond even that in terms of functionality. Another thing related to the iWatch that might be causing some issues is the display. The Economic Daily News is citing a G for Games report that says the iWatch is set to come out in three different variations, two different watch face sizes, a 1.6-inch display and a 1.8-inch display. They say the 1.8-inch display is the only one that will have sapphire glass, that the smaller one will not have sapphire. Earlier, Ming-Chi Kuo had said that the screen sizes were going to be 1.3 and 1.5 inch. So this kind of mirrors the two display sizes, but in a little bit larger size. We had also heard a Reuters piece a couple weeks ago that said it was going to have a whopping 2.5 inch display, which would be pretty huge. And they even commented that it might kind of overhang your wrist a little bit. I think that would be a little bit too large. I think the two different display sizes might go for like men's and women's designs. So I'm not sure I'm buying the sapphire versus non-sapphire version. I think, again, it's going to have sapphire glass on all of them, but I think different sizes to appeal to different demographics. You know, fashion's going to be a big part of the iWatch design, but the display, all of that technology, you know, might prove a little bit tricky for Apple, but I really think at the end of the day, there's no need to rush this thing to market. Apple has a little bit of time. I don't think anybody's come out as a clear leader in the wearables smartwatch space. So if they can't get it out this year and do it right, I think just put it off till next year, have it come out sometime later in 2015, and you'll be just fine. And then finally in the news for this week, Apple is partnering up with an old partner slash adversary to press further into the enterprise market with its products and services. Apple and IBM announced a deal that they're calling a landmark partnership in the enterprise market. With most Fortune 500 companies already deploying Apple's devices, Apple was already doing okay, but now with this IBM deal, I think it could make those efforts look small. There's a little bit of debate on this because people are saying Apple's already well into the enterprise with iOS devices. They're doing okay. IBM's not going to bring a lot to the table. But I see things a little bit differently. I think the deal with Apple will provide a lot more penetration into that enterprise market. The deal is that Apple's going to provide hardware and support services. IBM's going to come on board to help sell iOS devices to its corporate customers that use their cloud infrastructure. And the two together, IBM and Apple, are going to be working on developing over 100 native iOS versions of IBM's apps for their business customers. So if you've got native apps running on iOS devices, IBM's going to sell that stuff into the enterprise market along with their cloud services. They also said that that's going to coexist and work with Apple's own iCloud initiatives and all come together to help Apple and IBM just, I think, dominate the enterprise. You know, the deal is, I think this works on a bunch of different levels, and it's not just about the Fortune 500. One of the big things here is that more and more companies, large and small, are going to be seeing a serious enterprise company, IBM, looking to Apple solutions to solve problems. And that's going to make them think, you know what, maybe if IBM is doing this and IBM's customers are doing this, maybe I should be doing this for my own business. So there's going to be that translation. Also, IBM doesn't just deal with Fortune 500 companies. We're talking about a myriad of different companies. And specifically, I think what you're looking at is large business verticals. IBM serves some pretty big markets, things like retail and healthcare and banking and travel, telecommunications, insurance. These are places where Apple devices can get a foothold, and that's going to lead to additional services and sales and things like that. Another cool thing is that Apple also announced that along with the partnership, they're going to be selling a new AppleCare for Enterprise service that's going to provide 24/7 support to the businesses, to their IT departments and their IT heads, as well as their corporate users. So a big area of pushback traditionally for Apple's devices and products and services has been that IT department. This is going to help give them some support and hopefully help in the transition. I don't know how much of a difference that is going to make, at least at first. But if the devices are coming in, at some point the IT departments are going to have to manage and deal with them. If they don't have the experience, at least they have some backup, some folks that they can call up and turn to. So hopefully that will help. But I think this is kind of a big deal. I think we're going to see a lot more, not just iOS devices, but eventually Macs and Apple products and services getting bigger and bigger in the enterprise. And if I was Microsoft, I'd be pretty concerned about this. And I think we've been hearing some inklings that, you know, this is kind of a shot across the bow, and IBM and some of the other enterprise computing solutions providers are going to sit up and take notice of this. But with that, that is going to do it for the news for this week. Going to kick off the feedback section with a great audio comment that I received from Richard, recently that I did an SSD upgrade. I finally did an SSD upgrade in my Mac. I know many of you have been pressuring me to do this for years, saying it was going to change my opinion about the whole upgrade of memory versus SSDs. You know, which one's better? Which one should you spend your money on? And I have to say, I'm probably moving into that SSD camp, but I think more recently I'm doing that because prices on SSD drives, solid state drives, have come way down. So if you have an older Mac, it's kind of clunking along, it's maybe a little bit slower, and you've already done the RAM upgrade, you've done those things, you might consider doing an SSD. And that's what Richard thought about when he was looking at his aging iMac.
Hi, Adam. Just wanted to call in with a review of the Samsung Evo 840 SSD drive. I emailed you a while back because I wasn't sure if it was going to be a worthwhile upgrade in my 2008 iMac, given that it's a SATA 2 connection, which tops out at 3 gigabits a second. The drive theoretically can run up to over 500 megabytes per second, and I've calculated that in my machine it's running anywhere from 375 to about 402 megabytes per second because of the older connector. And despite that, my goodness, it's made such an enormous difference to the machine. Really easy to set up, no firmware updates or any faffing. It was simply plug in. The only problem I had with upgrading was the actual drive mount that I bought. The first one that I got, basically putting a 2.5-inch drive into a 3.5-inch drive gap. Unfortunately, where on the Mac the SATA connections inside the Mac tend to be in a fixed location, the bracket didn't allow me to position the drive where the drive ports would normally be, and actually put it in the middle. So I tried drilling holes and trying to widen the screw holes, because Macs sometimes use unusual fitting methods instead of just standard screws to put the drive in place. Having given up on that, though, I got myself a much better bracket, and it all plugged in and it's running absolutely fantastically. I used SuperDuper to clone my drive before I put it in. I got myself a USB to SATA connector and just cloned it all across. The only downside to that is that I've had to reinstall OS X to get my recovery partition back on there. Apparently, if you'll use Carbon Copy Cloner, that will also move the recovery partition over, but I didn't particularly mind because it's always nice to have a nice fresh install of the latest OS X. So as I say, absolutely blistering speed, really lovely performance, having no beach balls apart from, you know, times when you'd expect to have a bit of a beach ball. It's completely changed my machine. Very glad that I got rid of that old 5-year-old drive that was in the machine, replaced it with something that's going to last a lot longer and hopefully won't ever suffer the reliability problems that you get with a spinning hard disk. So many thanks for the podcast, and talk to you again soon. Bye for now.
Hey, thanks, Richard. That is awesome. To put life into an older iMac like that, it's really done wonders as well for my 2011 MacBook Pro. Mine's not quite as old as yours, but yeah, it's like having a fresh new machine for a few $100s, right? So you don't have to do that full investment of buying a brand new machine. You know, at some point you got to make that decision, you know, is it worth upgrading my older system, or am I just ready to take that money and fund the purchase of a new computer? But it sounds like your iMac still has a lot of life left in it, and I wish you the best of luck with it. The other thing I want to thank you for pointing out is that whole issue of making sure that whatever mounting bracket you get, especially if you're replacing a 3.5-inch drive, is going to line up. So you're going to want to do a little bit of your homework, make sure that your ports are lining up, all the holes and screw holes and things like that for mounting are in the right position. And by that same token, I'll point out that if you're replacing a spinning hard drive, a 2.5-inch hard drive in a notebook, you might want to double check and see what your spacing is, because some of the 2.5-inch SSD drives might need a little bit of a spacer to get pushed up a little bit to line things up. They are 7 millimeters in height, and a lot of the Macs used to use a 9.5-millimeter 2.5-inch drive. So you might need a little spacer to go under your drive as well, or just kind of fill in that gap. So check in all that stuff before you do your upgrade. Another thing that you helped me out, Richard, and you probably didn't realize this, but you helped me out realize that when I did my upgrade, I did a similar process. I used a NewerTek USB universal drive adapter along with SuperDuper to clone my old internal hard drive over to my new SSD when it was, you know, not put into the case yet. And so I did my cloning, and then I swapped out the drive, and everything worked beautifully. But I did not think about the fact that SuperDuper was not cloning over my recovery partition. So sure enough, after I got your voicemail, I went and checked, and I did not have a recovery partition on my Mac anymore. I had been using it for a month and not realizing I didn't have a recovery partition. That's something I definitely didn't want. And so I really didn't want to have to totally wipe my SSD drive and reinstall OS X from scratch and go through all that, because I had already done that on my spinning drive. I had a pretty clean system already. And so luckily, I did a little poking around on Google, and I found a handy AppleScript application called Recovery Partition Creator from Christopher Silvertooth. And I'll have a link to it in the show notes at maccast.com. But basically, what it lets you do is recreate your recovery partition in place on your drive. And you can even create a recovery partition on a separate drive, like an external. So I was actually able to put my recovery partition on my, I had moved my old 500 gigabyte spinning drive that I was replacing over into a data doubler from OWC. So I had moved it over into my optical drive slot. So I could put a recovery partition on there. And that worked great. But there were some caveats to that. And one of those was that when you have it on a separate drive, you can't use features like Find My Mac, which we're going to be talking about in a little bit. That requires the recovery partition to be actually on your boot drive. So I didn't want it over there. I ultimately ended up using Recovery Partition Creator to actually recreate the recovery partition on my SSD boot drive. And the way Recovery Partition Creator works is, first, you're going to want to make sure you have full backups before you use it. Things worked pretty well for me. I had no issues, but it's always better to be safe than sorry. Make sure you have full backups just in case, because you're going to be, you know, messing with your primary boot drive. So if things go south, you might end up with a not bootable machine and need to recover. But the script is basically creating a new partition, formatting it, and then loading on the OS X recovery system. So you download, you're going to need a copy of the OS X installer application before you run Recovery Partition Creator. So if you need to do that, you can go ahead and open up your App Store, go to the Purchases tab, and you should find your OS install there and click the Download button. When it finishes downloading, it's going to try and run the installer. So what you're going to want to do is just quit out of that. Don't run the installer. And it should leave the installer application in your applications folder. So, so if it was Mavericks, for example, you'd see an app called install OS10Mavericks.app. Leave that there. Once you have it there, you're going to want to prepare your drive. You do need to have a clean drive that's free from errors to be able to do this. So it's probably a good idea to open up Disk Utility and just run repair and check things on the drive before you actually run it. And I actually ended up having to do this because the first time I tried to create the partition, it didn't work. And I realized that, you know, I had some issues on my drive that needed to be cleaned up. So I had to boot from a USB drive that I had set up, a recovery volume, and then run repair permissions on my boot volume, or repair disk, rather, on my boot volume to get those things cleaned up. And then once I did that, I was able to run Recovery Partition Creator. What it'll do is it will show you which version of OS X you currently are running when you first launch it. You're going to want to remember that, because then it's going to ask you to find the volume that you want to create the recovery partition on, and it will ask you to verify that volume. Now, you can skip that step. I chose to verify it, but like I was saying earlier, the first time it failed, even though I verified it. So it verified with its tool, but there were still some issues on the drive that Disk Utility found. So I would recommend using Disk Utility first, and then also verify the volume when you're doing the Recovery Partition Creator. But then after that, it's going to ask you to locate your OS X install app, the one that you downloaded earlier, and then it will ask you which version do you want to create the recovery partition for, which version of the operating system. That's when you're going to want to use the thing that you noted earlier. Make sure you're installing the same version that's installed on your boot volume. And then once that's done, you let it do its thing. It's going to go ahead and create the volume, set it up for you, and then when it's done, it will tell you. And then you can do a restart, hold down Command R to boot into the recovery partition just to verify and make sure that it's working. Now, as I was doing this, I learned another little trick. There's actually a terminal command that you can run that will enable a debug menu to appear in the Disk Utility application. And once you have that debug menu, it actually has an option that says show every partition. So normally in Disk Utility, when you're looking at your volumes, you don't see the recovery partition. If you turn this feature on using the debug menu, you can actually see the recovery partition and verify that it got created on your boot volume. I'll have a link to that command in the show notes at maccast.com if you want to run it. But it's basically one of those default write commands that you run in the terminal to enable hidden and additional features in Mac OS X. So I'll have that there if you want to check it out. But you actually can recreate a recovery partition on drive if it's not there in place with this little tool. And again, it worked great. Make sure you have full backups. But thanks, Richard, for the review. And thanks for making me discover that I didn't have that recovery partition, because that was something that I'm happy I found out about sooner than later. And as I alluded to in that last segment, a good reason to know about that sooner is that another feature I like to use on my Mac is Find My Mac. So if my Mac ever gets lost and stolen, I can go use the Find My iPhone app or go into iCloud and actually determine where my Mac might be. But for that functionality to work, you do need to have, or to even be able to enable it, you do need to have a recovery partition on your Mac. But, you know, I think a lot of us know about the Find My features, Find My iPhone, Find My Mac, but, you know, really, do we know how they work or when they work or why they work? That was something that actually Greg was wondering about.
I'm listening to your update on the guy's hard drive that got stolen out of a hotel computer. And it's got me thinking about my computer and my encryption. And I think on my MacBook Pro 15-inch Retina, I'm not really sure if that solid-state drive is removable or not removable. If it's soldered in, maybe it's just the MacBook Air that has a soldered-in hard drive, so you really couldn't take it out without taking the whole machine. Anyway, my bigger question point is it a good practice to leave a test user account or a user with limited access, so if the machine is stolen, they actually, you start using it, take it to a coffee shop, log into Wi-Fi, stuff like that, rather than completely locking them out of the system? Because with the Find Me features of, location services, I think you need to have them log into those Wi-Fis, et cetera, in order to locate or wipe your machine if you need to. I had a case where one of my bosses at work had that happen. His machine was stolen, and it was logged in, and the only way we really found it was using those features. He had actually tried selling it at a bar and, pawning it off as his own, just doesn't need it anymore, etc., and we really wouldn't have been able to find it and do that without those Find Me features of the system. So, thinking that it may be appropriate to have a user account that's kind of test user, no password, that way they can log in if it's stolen, your other data still encrypted, unobtainable. Wanted to get your thoughts on that, if that is a good practice to have in place. Thank you.
Hey, Greg. That actually is a good practice to have in place, but it's also something that is kind of, in some ways, built into the system. I'm going to try and describe this a little bit. I think we need to back up a little bit and first describe, how Find My or what Find My Mac is for anybody who doesn't know what it is. It's a feature on your Mac that allows you to work through iCloud. It's set up through iCloud and allows you to find your missing Mac geographically using the Find My iPhone app for iOS or through iCloud.com. So if your machine ever gets lost or stolen, you can log in there and it will use Wi-Fi triangulation to kind of geographically pinpoint your Mac and show you where it is on a map. And then you can hopefully go find it and recover it. Or if it's been stolen, maybe you can help engage the help of the authorities to kind of help track it down and find it and recover it. And you can also use the feature to actually, as Greg was alluding to, either remotely wipe the system, so if you have sensitive data on there, or you can even lock it out and have it display a message, hey, if found, here's a reward, or call, whatever it might be, so that, again, you can hopefully get your Mac back. And it does require that the Mac is, one, powered on, and two, that it does have a connection to the internet. So it's going to need to be, in many cases, like an open Wi-Fi, or maybe, hopefully, the thief or person is dumb enough to actually connect it to Wi-Fi so that it can work. The remote wipe and remote lock can still work as long as the Mac is on. It doesn't have to be on Wi-Fi, but of course it does need to be connected to a network. So the finding feature needs to be reliant on Wi-Fi because it uses the Wi-Fi triangulation because it doesn't have a GPS system built into it to actually tell you where it is. But the other features, remote wipe, remote lock, can actually be enabled. It's just plugged in and connected to even a wired network. But, it does need to be turned on first. To set up the feature, you need to go into System Preferences. You need to select iCloud, sign in with your iCloud account if you're not already, and then check on the Use Find My Mac option and agree to allow it to use location services so that it actually can do the whole Wi-Fi location thing. And then, if your Mac is ever lost and stolen, finding it is a matter of using iCloud.com or the Find My iPhone app. Even though we're finding a Mac, it's through Find My iPhone on an iOS device. And so you can visit iCloud.com and log in with your username and password, click on the Find My iPhone option. Again, Find My iPhone, even though it's a Mac. And then after a brief period, it should show your Mac and all your other devices that are registered with the Find My service, and you can click on all devices at the top of the window in iCloud.com to see a list of the ones that it's found. And then from there, it gives you different options to do things like play a sound. It will play a really annoying loud sound, and it's always at 100% volume, even if the machine has been put on mute. You can lock it or you can erase it, and we'll describe that in a little more detail here in a little bit. And Find My iPhone works very similarly, but on iOS devices. If you want to remotely lock your Mac, what'll happen is that it will immediately ask you to set a passcode and then lock the Mac with that passcode remotely. So the next time it's on and connected to a network, it's going to get that that lock code, and you won't be able to get into the machine or access anything without it. And any activity that's currently going on, so if they were logged in and using it, they would get logged out and locked out of the system. The good news, though, when you lock it is that all of the data is maintained. The one disadvantage of remotely locking is that once you remotely locked it, you will no longer have the option to remotely erase the machine. So once it's locked, you can't erase it until you've actually logged in with a lock code password, and then you can go through the process of reformatting or erasing it. So when you choose to lock a Mac, it's going to warn you that it's not going to be able to be replaced. It will also give you the option to display a message on the Mac, and after setting the passcode, it will only boot to the recovery partition and will require the passcode to do anything further. If you choose the erase feature, it's going to wipe the drive and also set a passcode lock. So again, you're going to set a passcode, and you can also, again, set a message, but it will fully wipe all of the information, and it could take some time to do that, depending upon the size of your drive. So it could take a day or more. So the first thing it does is sort of put it in that lockout mode, and then slowly in the background, it's going to work to actually erase and wipe all that data. And so after that, if you ever do recover the machine, you're going to have to enter the passcode. It's going to boot the recovery partition and give you the option to reinstall the operating system. But all your data will be lost if you use the erase feature, which is exactly what you want. And so the Find My Mac feature does work without being logged into the system, at least sort of. What's going on is OS X stores on the recovery volume your credentials for iCloud and the status, whether the Find My feature is enabled or disabled. And so that information is there and available to the system at the lock screen, but it does need to be able to get online and those sorts of things. So what you can do is you can enable a guest account on your system. And the guest account in Mac OS X is this special account that can be used without credentials. And to set it up, you go into System Preferences, into Users and Groups, click on the little lock icon at the bottom, and enter your admin credentials, and then you select the guest account. You'll see one set up there. And then if you just check on the enable option for that account, you will have the guest account available and accessible from that lock screen when you boot up the Mac. And as a matter of fact, with the guest account, you can even set up parental controls to kind of further limit the access to applications, websites, and things like that. If you use FileVault, FileVault 2 whole disk encryption on your Mac, the guest account will only be able to access Safari. So it's kind of set up in this special mode where it's not going to be able to function and work with apps and stuff like that. The other nice thing about the guest account is that it kind of lives in its own separate space in terms of the user account. So when a person logs in with a guest account, even if they can use applications and things like that, once they log out of the guest account, it wipes out any data, any information, so it doesn't save any of that stuff. So it's kind of this little sandboxed account that you can set up. And I think you're right, Greg, you might want to turn that on and set that up as kind of an enticement. So when the thief or someone boots up the system, they see your account there, it's got a password in it, they don't want to take the time to try and hack that password. Oh, guest, I can log in as a guest. And they might try to poke around in there. And that might be enough to kind of give you some time to use the Find My feature to remotely wipe, remotely lock, or actually find your device. So I played around with this a little bit, and Find My Mac does seem to work as long as you have iCloud on and enabled in your main account and that guest account exists. It didn't appear to me like you even needed to log in. It seemed to Find My Mac even when I was sitting there just on, you know, logged out on the lock screen. But the two things that I think you need to do is turn on the Find My Mac feature and also enable that guest account. And if you do that, I think it's going to work just fine. So I hope that helps out and sheds a little bit more light on the Find My Mac features. Listener Ali emailed me to let me know he just started using iTunes Match, the iTunes Match service from Apple. That's the service that allows you to have Apple scan all of the music that's on your Mac and try and find matches for it in the iTunes service. And if it does, it gives you streaming remote access to all of that stuff without having to sync it to your devices. I'm actually a huge fan of the iTunes Match service, and I've been using it for, I think, a little over a year now, and I plan on continuing using it. I absolutely love it. One of the neat features about the service is that for any music that's in your library, your iTunes library, that it finds but it doesn't match on iTunes, it will actually take that and upload it to iTunes in the cloud and, again, give you streaming access to that. So it's like your own content. And what's cool about that is it actually doesn't count against your... I don't think it counts against your storage service in iTunes. So if you have your 5 gigabytes, I think any of the match stuff actually doesn't count against that. But it's that part of the service, the matching and uploading part, that Ali was actually finding some trouble with. He explained in his email that he doesn't want all of the stuff that's not matched to actually be uploaded. So he was asking, is there a way to actually selectively tell iTunes Match, hey, don't upload these files. I don't want these going up into the cloud. And unfortunately, Ali, the short answer is no. It's kind of an all for all or nothing thing. And I'm going to say it's mostly no because there's a couple of rules to iTunes Match that you may be able to leverage to kind of get it to do what you want. For songs that are not matched in iTunes, it will only upload files if the bitrate on the source audio, the stuff that's in your iTunes library, is 128 kilobits per second or higher. So, for example, in my own account, I have some voice memos and things like that that are at a lower bitrate. It's obviously not going to find matches for that in iTunes, and it also does not upload that stuff because it's technically ineligible for the iTunes Match service. Another thing is that it will only upload MP3 format or AAC formatted files, although for other kinds of files, things like AIFF and those sorts of things, if they are larger than 120, or if they're encoded at a bitrate higher than 128 kilobits per second, they apparently do get converted over to MP3 or AAC and then uploaded. Another thing is it will not upload any files that are over 200 megabytes. So if you have very large files, it's not going to upload those into the cloud. And it will also only upload music files. It will not upload things like audiobooks and podcasts and other types of formats. So you could kind of use the rules to prevent specific files from being uploaded. So maybe take your files you don't want uploaded and encode them at a lower bit rate. That may or may not be something that is desirable for you. Specifically, another thing I could think of is you could change the kind of media to audiobook. That might work, but could be really inconvenient because it's going to move all of your music and tracks into the audiobook section, making it a little bit harder to find those sorts of things. But if you wanted to do that, the first thing you'd have to do is turn off iTunes Match, and then you could go in and select the track. You choose File Get Info from the menu. And then in the Get Info window, go to the Options tab, and then you can change the Media Kind setting to something other than music, and then turn iTunes Match back on, and it's not going to match any of your audiobooks. And I'm saying that in air quotes, because now you might have music in your audiobooks. But I really don't think that's desirable. And I think in your email, you mentioned that some of your audiobooks were uploading. I'm guessing those audiobooks have their Media Kind set to music still, which is probably why they're still uploading. The only other thing I could think of, and I'm hoping some of you might have a suggestion for Ali, but the only other thing I could think of was you can create a separate iTunes library to keep the thing, just the items in that you don't want matched or picked up by iTunes Match. So if you hold down the Option key when you open up iTunes, you'll get a little menu, and in that menu there's an option, or a dialogue, and in that dialogue there's an option for creating a new library. So you could create a new library, add any tracks into that library that you didn't want in iTunes Match, and just leave them in there, and then don't enable iTunes Match on that second library, and then they'll never get uploaded into the cloud. And then the disadvantage to this is you're going to have to switch back and forth between libraries if you want to access that media content. And you just do that again by holding down the Option key when firing up iTunes, and then you'll notice there's a Choose Library option. So you could switch back and forth between one library and the other. And I don't think really convenient, but it just depends on how big of an annoyance this is that it's sort of uploading this stuff that you don't want it to upload. So I hope that helps out. Maybe some of you have a better suggestion for Ollie. If you do, shoot us an email, and we'll try and follow up on future episodes of the MacCast. And then the last little thing that I have for you today is actually a really great tip, something that came about from some interviews and an article written up by my friend Dave Hamilton over at the Mac Observer. There's actually a really great post on 4 great Wi-Fi tips, tips for improving your Wi-Fi in your house that he got after talking with Alf Watt, who is a former Wi-Fi engineer at Apple and also creator of the iStumbler application. For those of you who don't know, iStumbler is this great little utility that you can use to analyze your Wi-Fi network. And so you can see all of the devices on your Wi-Fi network. You can see the Wi-Fi networks around you and get information on them, like the signal strength and things like that. Really, really great tool. And I've used it for years. So you should definitely check that out. But in this interview that Dave did, he kind of discovered these 4 little tips. And I'm just going to summarize these here. I'll have a link to the full article at Mac Observer if you want to check that out and get all of the details. But the 4 tips are, and number 1 is really the biggest one for me. This really changed my own home network. I did this probably about a year ago, and that is use the same SSID name, the same name for all of the routers that are on the same network. So many of us have multiple routers now because maybe you have a larger house or a larger space you need to cover. So you might have a base station router, and then maybe you have some routers like an Airport Express to extend that. You want to make sure that you set the same name on all of those, even though there's kind of this tendency to think, well, this is a 2.4 gigahertz device, and I want to have a different name for that one so that I know I'm connecting to 2.4 gigahertz. Don't do that. Name them all the same thing. And the reason is that your Mac is smart about picking which network. It's actually smarter than doing it by hand, because if you do it by hand, it's always going to try and connect to the ones in a certain order, and that may or may not be the best connection. So if you just let the Mac pick and choose, it's going to pick the best connection that it can find in terms of performance and signal strength. So use the same name on all of your routers. If you are using more access points and you have the ability, turn down the transmitting power if you can. So a lot of people think, oh, I want to boost the signal strength up, because some routers will let you tweak that setting, the little TX transmission power setting. I'm going to boost it up to maximum and just blow everything else away. And that actually becomes a problem, especially if you have multiple access points, because you could have one running over the other. And another great tip, just side tip, is if you have multiple access points, if you could hardwire them rather than using Wi-Fi, that's always a good thing to do. Look into power line adapters. These are the things that let you run a network connection over the power lines, so the electrical outlets in your house. That's what I use to actually reach a remote room of my house, and we've talked about that on MacCast. I have a base station in an office, and then in a bedroom hooked up on power line, I have another Airport Express base station, and it works really, really well. The third tip is don't use wide 40 megahertz channels on your 2.4 gigahertz network. If you own Apple routers, you won't even have to bother with this, because it's just not an option. But again, some third-party routers allow you to tweak that setting. Don't use it. That's just going to, again, cause more problems for you. And then the last trick has to do with any routers that have those little external antennas that you can kind of orient and point. A lot of newer routers have 2 of those antennas in there, and they say if you have 2 of them, make them perpendicular to each other. So one pointing straight up, one horizontally at a 90-degree angle to that one pointing straight up. And the reason you want to do that is because Alf Watt says radio reception is actually maximized when both the client and the access point have matched polarization, or basically antennas pointing along the same plane. And some Macs, like MacBook Pros, actually have a horizontally aligned antenna. So if you can get that in line with the antenna on the base station, that's going to give you your best reception. So I didn't know a lot of these tips. These are really, really great tips. If you want to get more of this stuff, Dave actually did an interview, and I think he based his article on the interview he did with Al Watt on his Mac Geek Gab podcast, which is another great Mac podcast. If you're not listening to it and checking it out, Dave and John Braun do a lot of tips and tricks and help their audience, you know, with these kinds of technical issues. They're a bit more technical from time to time than I am, but I think it's a great podcast, and you really should check it out if you're not. So I'll have a link to that too. You can just go over to Mac Observer, just search for Mac Geek Gab, and check that out. And thanks for Dave for writing this up, because I thought it was a really great tip and some good advice for improving Wi-Fi, which is something that comes up on the MacCast all the time. People are always looking to improve their Wi-Fi. So check those tips out and let me know if any of those helped you out. I certainly know the SSID naming thing helped me out a lot. But with that, that is going to do it for this episode of the MacCast. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors: Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disk Label, also Text Expander Touch for your iOS devices, as well as PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad. And also be sure to check out PDF Pen Scan Plus, all great applications. You can get more information and details over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, it's the fast and simple way to sell your used gadgets. You can find out what your used iPhone, iPad, or other Apple products are worth by going to gazelle.com. And lynda.com. Lynda.com helps you learn and keep up to date with your software, pick up brand new skills, or even explore new hobbies with their easy-to-follow video tutorials. Really great stuff. You can get a free trial by going to lynda.com/MacCast. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MacCast. Bandwidth for the MacCast is provided by CacheFly. They're at CacheFly.com. And advertising is handled by Backbeat Media at BackbeatMedia.com. If you enjoyed the show, if you have any feedback for me, if you have a comment, you have a question, you have something you'd like to hear covered on a future episode of the MacCast, please feel free to email me. I welcome emails and audio comments. You can send those to MacCast@gmail.com. You can also call in on my listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-MAC-IAM-9. You can leave voicemail there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype, and my Skype username is TheMacCast. If you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those at MacCast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And if you'd like to follow me on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast, or check out the MacCast Facebook page at facebook.com/TheMacCast. Those are great places to hang out between shows. We also have a Google Plus community. Just search for MacCast on Google Plus. And I hope to see you online. But until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.